First Kings chapter 9, and our theme this morning is entitled A Wise Master Builder. A Wise Master Builder. Solomon is one of those people that others may get jealous of, or perhaps envious of. Clever, rich, married to a famous daughter, well connected, and everything he does turns to wealth and gold. It is hard to compete with such a person. But what are we to make of him? Is it all really down to being born, as we might say, with a silver spoon in his mouth? Is that really the reason why he has these things? Our culture would conclude that those who are born rich, because they have such advantages, they are therefore clever and they do well and marry well and so on. Well, if that is true, then why did it not work for Absalom or Adonijah? Reminding us that it is not the context of his birth in terms of riches and advantage and material things that ultimately matters. Evidently, the answer lies elsewhere, which is why chapter 9 is so important. But as we come to this ninth chapter, we are faced with a question: what are we to make of this chapter? Verses 1 to 9 seem fairly straightforward, clear enough, easily to be understood, but the rest of the chapter seems to be a sort of haphazard collection of bits and pieces. Well, that's why we need to read the chapter more carefully to see how it all hangs together. And there is one word that occurs throughout this chapter, and let's just note the verses, and I trust you will see the word that keeps appearing. Verse 1. And it came to pass when Solomon had finished the building of the house of the Lord and the king's house and all Solomon's desire which he was pleased to do. Verse 3. And the Lord said unto him, I have heard thy prayer and thy supplication that thou hast made before me. I have hallowed this house which thou hast built to put my name there forever. And so on. Verse 10. And it came to pass at the end of 20 years, when Solomon had built the two houses, the house of the Lord and the king's house. I'm sure you begin to realize it is the word build that keeps occurring. And again in verse 15, 17, 24 and 25. So the word build is fundamental to the chapter. And we see that Solomon is a man who builds. But there is another word that occurs as well that we must note, and it is in verse 1 as well. And the king's house and all Solomon's desire. And that word is repeated again in verse 19, which Solomon desired to build. So we see then that Solomon was a man with a passion for building. And that's what we see throughout this whole chapter. Now, the chapter itself falls naturally and neatly into two parts. The first part is verses 1 to 9, and the second part, verse 10 through 28. So that gives us our two points and parts this morning. First of all, the spiritual foundation, verses 1 to 9. You see, when looking at a successful person, rarely does God come into the picture. And when it does, our culture is shocked and disappointed and annoyed. Let me give you a contemporary example. When the chief executive of Yahoo said that her priorities were God, family and Yahoo, there were many choked on their coffee. They thought this was dreadful. Bad enough to mention God, but to put God first, the person must be a real nutcase, and the business is going to be a complete disaster, having such a fanatic running any business. Well, here is Solomon, and before you look at anything, the writer says, if you don't see this, you have missed the building and the passion for building. The writer brings us face to face with God. Notice in passing the reference to the first appearance of God to Solomon, reminding us that Solomon's life thus far cannot be appreciated without considering that first appearance by God to him. And the writer is saying, you cannot understand chapter 9 and Solomon's occupation and his passion for building and all that he acquires and does unless you see just how fundamental and crucial God is to his life. And there are a few things in these 9 verses. First of all, the privilege. Verse 3. The Lord said unto him, I have heard thy prayer and thy supplication that thou hast made before me. I have hallowed this house which thou hast built. God here is telling Solomon that he has now authorized the temple as a means of grace. And he tells him something wonderful. All who come to this temple have access to me. Look at how he puts it. To put my name there forever, and mine eyes, and my heart shall be there perpetually. In this house, at this public means of grace, my name, mine eyes, and my heart shall all be there. That is truly remarkable and astonishing. God speaking anthropomorphically says, if you wish to draw near to me, come to where I am. Come to me. At this temple, there is nowhere closer, he's saying, than this public means of grace. Seek me, and you will find me to the fullest. My name, mine eyes, and my heart. That truly is remarkable, isn't it? Getting close to God. Having that intimacy of fellowship with God himself. When you come through the doors of that temple to worship me, you'll find me there. I'll be there waiting for you. And secondly, the assurance, verses 4 and 5. And notice the form it takes. If that, then this. If thou wilt walk before me, as David thy father walked in integrity of heart and in uprightness, to do according to all that I have commanded thee, and will keep my statutes and my judgments, then I will establish the throne of thy kingdom upon Israel forever. God makes a simple promise. Not a complicated promise. It's a promise that he makes repeatedly throughout Scripture. Blessing follows obedience. Obedience comes before blessing. If thou wilt walk before me, to do according to all that I have commanded thee, will keep my statutes and my judgments. He's talking about obedience. If you obey me, Solomon, I will bless you. I will bless you in your life. I will establish the throne of thy kingdom upon Israel forever. The third element, verses 6 to 9, the warning. And this is also in the form of if, then. But if ye shall at all turn from following me, ye and your children, and will not keep my commandments and my statutes, which I have set before you, but go and serve other gods and worship them, then will I cut off Israel out of the land which I have given them. There are three elements to this. First, he tells them, personal apostasy will bring national judgment. Personal apostasy. That's very sobering, isn't it? Solomon, if you as a king, as an individual, turn from me, the consequences will bring catastrophe upon the nation. National consequences. So you see, friends, our personal walk with God matters. You matter. And secondly, the temple will become a visible sign of that judgment. Judgment begins at the house of God. If you were to ask me, what is a visible sign of the judgment of God upon the nation? I would say, look at the state of the church in the nation. In its doctrine, worship, and government, it has departed from God. There is the visible sign of that apostasy, of that turning from God. And thirdly, the mockery of the ungodly will confirm the sin of apostasy and its judgment. Look at what it says. And at this house which is high, he says, Israel shall be a proverb and a byword among all people. Everyone that passeth by it shall be astonished and shall hiss, and they shall say, why hath the Lord done thus unto this land and to this house? And they shall answer, because they forsook the Lord their God. Essentially what the writer is saying is this. Pagan mothers will say to their children, if you don't watch, you'll end up like the Israelites. That's what the pagans will say. And that's what the pagans are saying about us. Look at what has happened to the United Kingdom, to the West, those nations that once professed Christ. And the pagans are saying to their offspring, if you don't watch out, we'll end up like them. We become a byword. It's a solemn warning, isn't it? And yet it is a most appropriate warning. It is saying to us, our personal walk with God is of fundamental importance to the nation and to the very welfare of the cause of God. Your personal walk is of fundamental importance. Then secondly, verses 10 to 28, the secular accomplishments. And there are four sections to this, or four elements to this section. And before anyone turns their noses up at this particular section, remember, Solomon is a king and he's doing a king's business. These are king's things. First of all, politics, verses 10 to 14. And here we see that Solomon is not the only one who has problems with other countries. He had his problems like others. In this case, it was with Hiram. Hiram, we note, wasn't happy with what Solomon was giving him. Of course, it raises the question, why was Solomon giving him anything? Why was he giving him cities that belonged to the land of Canaan? That's an interesting question. Well, in light of verse 11, the only explanation is that it was payment for what Hiram gave him. It may be that Solomon was spending more than he was getting in, and he was giving him something in return, more concrete. But Hiram went on an inspection. He went on a city tour, and he was not best pleased. He was not happy. And indeed, he called the whole lot of them one word, Kabul, which a margin tells you means dirty. That's what he thought of the cities that Solomon was giving him. But beyond complaining, what else could he do, especially in light of what is to come towards the end of the chapter? Secondly, defense, verses 15 to 24. And there are two elements to this. You have the Canaanites, and we're told that Solomon put the Canaanites to tribute. And that is because they were not Israelites, and they did not worship the God of Israel, and they were therefore put to tribute. They should not, in fact, be in the land. But this is simply the fruits of a historic failure. We're told of that failure. The children of Israel were not able utterly to destroy them. So that historic failure has ongoing consequences, but Solomon deals with it in an appropriate manner. He places a tribute upon them, a tribute of bond service. The second element is construction. We note that a number of border towns were fortified to give greater protection to Israel. So there's nothing wrong with defense. And Solomon, as a king, has a duty to protect his citizens, to defend his citizens. And we have rulers, sadly, who do not seem to believe in protecting their citizens and defending their nation, but seem to think that conceding everything is the best policy. The third element, religion, verse 25, and three times in a year did Solomon offer burnt offerings and peace offerings upon the altar and so forth. Here we see that orthodoxy was publicly promoted. He's unashamedly a servant of God. Verse 25 refers to Exodus 23, verses 15 to 17. And there are three feasts that were set out for the Israelites: the Feast of Unleavened Bread, the Feast of Harvest, and the Feast of Ingathering. And Solomon keeps these three essential feasts. No doubt he kept all of the others, but our attention is drawn to the Feasts of Israel. It is simply setting before us orthodoxy is being maintained. The cause of Christ is being maintained. But there is one fascinating element in verse 25. It's the very last clause. So he finished the house. Well, we know that the temple was finished in chapter 8. But the word finished used here does have other meanings. Not to construction, but to something else, and is variously translated as pay, render, perform, and so on. So there are two ways of viewing this particular clause. Either the temple itself was not truly regarded as finished until it was ready for worship, or Solomon met all the religious obligations set by the Mosaic law. And the latter seems to be more appropriate given the reference to Exodus 23 and the Mosaic obligations that were laid upon the people, and thus confirming for us that as far as Solomon was concerned, he nailed his colours to the mast, we might say. He took a stand for the cause of God and for religious orthodoxy unashamedly, and that's what he promoted in the nation. There was a time we had rulers who did do that unashamedly so, but now we have rulers who don't even believe in God. How things have changed. And the fourth element, verses 26 to 8, is commerce. Gold from Ophir by Solomon's navy with harems, Phoenician sailors. So Haram didn't lose out after all. He may not have liked the little towns that Solomon gave him, but he's still making money nonetheless. Well, let's come to application of this. What are the lessons to be drawn from this particular chapter? What are the principles that are set out for us as God's people from this chapter? Well, first of all, very simply, in the business of life and living, don't forget the foundation. Verses 1 to 9 is the foundation. Some commentators, they complain about all the secular business that Solomon is engaged in verses 10 to 28, as if it's all too worldly and he should have nothing to do with it. But they forget he is God's king and he is to administer the affairs of the nation. And there is no criticism by the writer, either implicitly or explicitly. And do we not find ourselves having to engage in these worldly business activities? The real question is not that we are engaged in worldly business. The question is, are we doing it all as God's people? That's the fundamental question. And do not forget two things. The foundation of life, which is living for God. And the second is the regular worship of God. Verse 25. Here are these two hedges, so to speak, within which we travel. Living and worshipping God. Doing all for God. And the regular worshipping of God. And here I would say to all of you, do not let lawful, worldly business things crowd out God or the worship of God. Imagine Solomon saying, well, I've offered all these sacrifices. If you just take these three feasts, well, I've offered these three feasts last year. One will do me this year. Would that be right? It would not be in keeping with the commandments of God. Or perhaps saying, well, I'm a bit busy this year, so I'll shift the dates to suit myself. Would that be satisfying the obligations laid upon him? Or I've done three last year, I'll do two this year. At different times. Or maybe I'll combine all three of them together at one point in time. That would be a clever thing to do, wouldn't it? And that would free me up for other things. It wouldn't be in keeping with serving God. And let us not let business things, worldly things, crowd out God from our lives or the regular worshipping of God. When we are called to worship God, let's always be prepared to set everything to one side and to come to worship God. In the business of life, don't forget the foundation. But But then secondly, making the right decisions. Verses 3-9. Life is full of decisions. And in every decision, we either decide for God or against God. Take an everyday illustration. Someone has a job, and they're happy in their job, and they belong to a particular church. Suddenly they get an offer of promotion which takes them, shall we say, to Timbuktu, and they say, fantastic, and off they go. When they get there, where are they going to worship? There is no church. What are they going to do? What have they done? They've made the wrong decision. They didn't put God first. God says to Solomon, always choose me. That's what he's saying to him. Always choose for me. Not only do it once, but do it all the time. In every decision, in every choice, always choose for God. And sometimes that choosing for God means denying yourself. So the one who was offered the promotion, choosing for God, would have meant saying no, because I would have had to leave my congregation and go off where there is nowhere, to nothing. Spiritually, I'd be a disaster. There's a sense in which we have entered into the narrow way. We're on the narrow way. That does not mean that thereafter your decisions don't matter. They do. Every day you live, you're faced with options and alternatives. What is going to guide your decision making? It has to be the law of God. You take out the law of God and you apply it to the options. What is the right thing to do? And we often struggle with this question. What is the right thing to do? Well, the law of God will guide you. Always choose for God. That's what God is saying to Solomon. Solomon, you will have many alternatives, many options. But in every decision, choose for me. And then thirdly, holding the right balance. Look carefully at verses 24-28. What are the big subjects in these three particular verses? Verses 24 and 25 and 26-28. Well, there are three elements, and as you go through Solomon's life, you will see these three elements always in competition. They're always side by side. We will put them this way: women, worship, and work, or wealth. We might put it girls, God, and gold. And Solomon, we discover, is often pulled in different directions. At the moment, God is in the center, and everything else surrounds that. But what happens when Solomon puts God second or third? Or if he ignores God? It's then that spirit of declension occurs and the threat of apostasy begins to loom. Then comes into play this warning in chapter 9, verses 6-9. Disobedience produces disaster. From now on, or for the moment, God is in the center. On either side, women are women and wealth. And God is central. But we will see that in Solomon's life, the women move to the center. And God moves to the side. And the tragedy of that. For some people, work moves to the center and God is put to the side. We have a word for them, workaholics. You know, all they can think about is work, work, work. And work is good, but a lawful thing can become a sinful thing when it predominates a life, when it becomes central and God is put to the side. There are hints, as we've noted before, of some future spiritual problems that Solomon had, but for now, everything is on balance. And there's lessons there for us, isn't there? Relationships, they can either help you spiritually or harm you. So I say to younger ones, choosing friends, choose with care. There's something, there's an exercise for you. Writing out a list. Who are your friends? Why are they friends? Should they be friends? What advantages are they to you spiritually? For others, what about your work, your duties, your vocation? That will either help you or hinder you spiritually. There's a task. Is your work doing that for you? Is it a help to you spiritually or a hindrance? Is it crowding out everything in your life? Has it become so dominant that you haven't enough time for spiritual things and you find that time has just been reduced to a fragment for spiritual things? You know what happens whenever work dominates? We start to cut off spiritual time, time for spiritual things. Well, maybe the midweek doesn't really matter. On the Lord's Day, we get jittery and fidgety about the Lord's Day and spending time, a whole day with God. We get fidgety. We get impatient. We need to take a hard look at ourselves. What is the balance in our life? What is central? Not what we say in theory, but what we actually do in practice. That's why forefathers used to keep diaries. At the end of each day, they would take a look at how they spent that day, what dominated that day. And if God wasn't in it, oh, they repented and they mourned and resolved, tomorrow, I'll not spend tomorrow like I did today. And fourthly and finally, success and prosperity is not an infallible indicator of being on the right road. You see, the real question is not, how successful are you in life? The real question is, are you keeping the first commandment? Are you walking, living, breathing obedience to God? That's the fundamental question. It doesn't matter in one sense how successful you are or how rich you are. This is the real issue. Let me put it to you this way. First, remembering the first commandment is our highest calling in life. Thou shalt have no other gods before me. That's the highest calling in life. And secondly, obedience to God's law is our holiest duty in life. That's what God is saying to Solomon. Solomon, this is the holiest duty in your life. Obedience to my law. And third, we might say, worshipping God is our happiest experience in life. Three times a year. Of course, we know he went every Sabbath day. He's keeping all of these feasts, all of the regulations in worship. Worshipping God is our happiest experience of life. At least it should be. We've come to worship God. We've come to a fellowship of God. Think of again of that statement that God makes in verse 3. My name, mine eyes, and my heart. Can there be anything happier than this? Of coming to meet with God. and singing to Him and His words gripping our hearts. It's truths impacting upon us time after time, no matter how often we sing them. Constantly being renewed and quickened and changed. It's our happiest experience. There's so many things that are dreadful and unhappy experiences. Going to the dentist is not a pleasant experience, but we know it's good for us. And then there are things that we think are really exciting and interesting. But if you were to do it all the time, you would get fed up with it. But never with worship. Never with worship. It's our happiest time. Oh, may God bless His word to our hearts this day. Amen.